So we'll go ahead and get started. I guess we're just a few minutes behind. Thank you all for sticking around for the last panel, which I think will be some of the best discussion that we've had today, which has already been obviously very dynamic and very useful. So in terms of format, I think what I'd like each one of the participants to do is just very quickly, I know some of them have been up here already, but just very, very quickly, in over 30 seconds or a minute or so, just give us a very quick backdrop on their organization. I think everyone's going without PowerPoint, so just give us a very quick understanding of their company, sort of their business, and any other distinguishing features. And then if we can do that, and then very quickly we'll just go into a Q&A session. I've got a few questions that I prepared. Hopefully a few of them are still relevant after all our discussion today. But and then we'll open it up to broader industry participation. So I know I talked with a number of you throughout the day, and certainly encourage you and anyone else to please come forward and have an opportunity to further discuss a lot of the important topics that we've raised so far today. So with that, Doug, if you can go ahead and kick us off. And obviously, we just heard from SunPower, but if you can just go ahead and refresh everyone's memory, and we'll just go ahead and go down with Charlie and the rest of the panel.
As I mentioned in my talk, SunPower is number one in most of the markets in the U.S., worldwide presence of about 5,000 employees. And based on this morning's information, I am now a huge believer in a high-level roadmap that we can communicate to DOE.
I'm Charlie Gay. I'm president of Applied Solar. Applied Materials is a company that makes equipment used to manufacture solar panels around the world. We're the world's largest producer of equipment in making solar panels. We have about 1,500 employees in the solar business.
Hi, my name is Kevin Hutchings. I'm the vice president of microelectronics R&D at IBM. We're at the center of some of these semiconductor collaborations that you've heard about today, and been a facilitator of and supporter of things like SRC and Semitech and others. You might be asking, why is IBM here? Beyond that, we believe that because of our experience, skills, and intellectual property in semiconductors, we have a lot to offer the PV industry from a technology point of view, and we're very interested in finding a way to help. So we're here to lend a hand and see if we can do that, both intellectually and through various collaboration models.
Hi, my name is John Gleckler. I'm CEO of Apogee Solar. Apogee Solar is developing a 50 micron solar cell, basically commercializing this sliver process that Australia was not able to commercialize. So that's our claim right there. The other claim is, though, is we've developed this process so that we can totally outsource it to various existing facilities in the world today. So we're looking at a fabless solar cell model versus a build-your-own factory type.
I'm Jim Moreland, Solar World in Hillsboro, Oregon. Headquarters is in Bonn, Germany. We are currently expanding and in a state with 10% unemployment. We're hiring, so we're doing well with respect to the rest of the economy. So we're just trying to keep on keeping on with crystalline and multicrystalline silicon. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you all very much for agreeing to be on this panel. I'd like to kind of step back into the pit of the last discussion. Contrary to popular belief, the initiative in terms of road mapping and the discussion that's gone on road mapping is not some DOE plan to sort of exert control over the industry. A lot of that actually came from material suppliers within the industry who had come to us in several instances and said, we are having trouble in terms of understanding where this industry is going. We're used to dealing with roadmaps in the semiconductor industry. we think there's a role for this. We think maybe DOE can play a role. Understanding everything that was said and really not disagreeing with it, because I understand that the analogies are not perfect between where TV industry and the semiconductor industry was and are. What would you say to those suppliers in terms of helping them align their R&D activities in order to be better suppliers to you as cell and module manufacturers and ultimately help you to be more competitive? So anybody who want to take that? Charlie?
Yes, I think the couple of comments I'd like to make here. One, in terms of the practicalities, although our name is Applied Materials, we're an equipment company. And so we work closely with materials companies like Dow Corning, who's here, like DuPont, like the producers of all of the feedstocks that are relevant here, so that what we can do is to combine the tool with the material in a way that gets the cost out for the PV customer. So as a first step, the kind of initiatives we've taken have been to meet with the raw material suppliers and say, we have a strategic plan around roadmaps where we think the technology is going. Everybody has a roadmap that is what guides their business. It's what allowed them to receive the financing necessary to fund them and to be differentiated. So part of what we're commingling is around where we compete and where we collaborate. The time constants, I think one of the parallels here, I was sitting here and I was thinking of Mark Twain's quote that when the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. We've brought together a lot of folks who want to help. And in the PV industry, we want that help. And we relate to things from our past. And so it's exciting that we have the folks from the IC industry here wanting to help. And what I think we can do, and I think this is a great process that has been initiated here today and is something that we can build up on, of the things that are different, just to kind of set the stage. In the IC industry, a concept that I like is technology half-life. Every 18 months or so, the technology has been obsoleted. Another node has been reached. That's what Moore's observation was all about. In solar, we could debate this, but technology half-life may be a decade. So the time constants that we work with, we do need to plan, but part of in that planning is a set of ideas that are what gets the financing brought in here. When Doug showed his slide of is it 6-inch or 8-inch, my reaction is, you know where 6-inch or 8-inch came from? It came from the IC industry. We started with a set of notions that the form factor needed to look like a wafer instead of maybe a rectangle or something. And part of the way that people differentiate is around those fundamental ideas. Even today, I had a call from some VC folks who said, we've got this great new thing, and it's about a cheap way to make silicon. You know, you can reduce quartz with sugar? And I said, you know, there was a report that JPL did in 1979 about how to do that. The technologies that are there, what we want to be doing is laying the foundations for the long haul and get the time constants right. What we would need to be able to do is have the universities link in here. And I liked what Jim Seitz had to say today about enabling the students and the faculty to be able to get engaged in ways that allow that innovation to come forward. One of the biggest barriers we have today is in the banking community. They look for consultants to give them guidance on what technology and PV is good to invest in. Well, I've been a consultant in my life. It's when I had no job. And so the banks are relying on folks that I would love to have call Jim Seitz and say, you know, you don't have to worry about competing with the other peer review panels on this proposal or that. because the expertise is there that can help give the confidence to the banking community who wants to know, so how long has this stuff been in the field? I'm expecting a return on my investment to happen, and it needs to be predictable. It needs to be based in energy delivery. We're selling energy, not power, although we can get some credit for the power. And so part of the networking that could be especially helpful here as well is to be aware of the fact we're bringing in a lot of new stakeholders, stakeholders from the IC world, stakeholders from the material supplier world, stakeholders from the banking community, who are actually helping create the financing models that could allow this industry to scale. The venture community, which in a sense, the ones I run into, say, we'll fund the R&D. Don't spend your time on that business plan trying to make up a story. I want to find out the answer in the next 3 months. They're significant to complementing the university role. We have a chance here to aggregate a lot of stakeholders because we want to change the situation of where we get energy. One quick sidebar, I apologize, John, but a story from yesterday. So I spent yesterday meeting with 8 senators and Carol Browner in the White House. And Dick Durbin from Illinois turned out to ask the most interesting questions about solar and where it stands and what about multi-junctions and multiple band gaps. And then he said the day before he had been visited by the farm constituency from Illinois. And they said, This cap and trade thing, what's in it for us? And Senator Durbin responded before kind of going down that path, he was wise enough to say, do you believe in global warming? None of them believe in global warming. So we have a lot of education we need to do, and we need all of you and all of the stakeholders we can possibly engage to try and get together on the same page. And so whether we call it a roadmap or whatever we call it, this process of coming together and being collaborators together in setting goals that relate to how much clean energy can be adopted and how much solar we could adopt would be a great thing for us to build off of this conference. So long answer to, we're cooperating with the material suppliers so that the cost of manufacturing, both the cost of ownership and the capital cost of the equipment, can come down as part of enabling this industry to grow. And it's different for a whole set of different people. Finding that common ground is very difficult, but it's up to each of us to find partners with whom we can collaborate. And from our equipment side, I just wanted to share that particular example of how to start off in a small step of collaborating one-to-one to say we can help you in the industry to improve efficiency or to lower the cost per watt or to do both.
Okay. Thank you, Charlie. Doug?
I wanted to quickly echo the point of having a way of pulling together this information, having the new companies that want to participate be able to learn more quickly where they should look to and be able to communicate that upwards is essential. But I want to caution against the idea of a roadmap that gives what some of the material suppliers want, which is like they're used to dealing with in the IC industry. Every industry is different. The makers for parts for jet engines are probably used to dealing with 2 or 3 customers. And if they got into this, they might want that. But that would harm the industry. We deal with some suppliers that are really uncomfortable because it's different than what they're used to. But they see that here's an industry that could grow with 40, 50, 60% CAGR. And they'll deal with the complexity of it and the need to learn and the need to work at it in order to participate in that.
Okay. Mickey.
Just a quick comment. One of the benefits that we've seen in the semiconductor industry, which I believe the PV industry will also see from this roadmap and working with suppliers and equipment materials and equipment people, is that there's a limited amount of money available to do R&D, whether it's material, whether it's equipment. And you can't do everything. You know, the discussion earlier was about the difference between giving people the freedom to pursue all different kinds of ideas versus kind of a narrow view. But the reality, which I think is true in a PV as well as the semiconductors, is a limited amount of money for R&D. So one of the benefits of a roadmap, however it could evolve for PV, is to make sure those limited R&D dollars are spent in the right place, right? And you know, whether you agree on a high-end top level view of dollars per or cents per kilowatt hour, which makes a lot of sense, you ultimately have to figure out how to get there. And you'll get into these discussions with suppliers and so on. It's like, I only got this much money to spend. Where do I spend it? Give me some guidance. And that's coming. And particularly if the main purpose of this meeting, particularly if you believe that this is all about how to fortify manufacturing in the United States, in which case you have to look at the cost per kilowatt hour and say, is that coming down fast enough for us to compete globally? And once you begin to answer that question, you'll find out whether or not that roadmap is adequate, and that'll lead to where do I spend all this limited R&D dollars. Just at the same thing at the DOE level, John, you have a limited amount of money to spend. Where are you going to spend it? Mm-hmm. You need some guidance. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a need for a roadmap, but there's obviously details that need to be worked out that are unique to the PV industry. But I do think this is something that's sorely needed.
I'd like to just add, because I agree, Derek, with you around it's different from semiconductor. There's design, which is where all the IP was. In PV, it's all in the process development itself. I think that the thing that I didn't hear today, and I think we're just crossing over, is that there are certain needs for standards to get other companies involved and grow the critical mass of this industry, whether it's equipment manufacturers, whether it's glass manufacturers for our panels. They're all of the same opinion, which is, where if there's no standard, how do I know that there's going to be a market for my product and my R&D dollars? And we have to be able to reduce the risk of the market risk in many areas and allow companies to say, if I can meet this spec or meet this standard, then I have a market. So let me give you the example. I was in the Wi-Fi market when there was none. There were six standards. One standard emerged, 802.11b, and then G, and then N. But that drove companies, both small and large, ability to invest in those areas with an assurance that the market was going to be there. And they didn't have to worry about the technology risk and the market risk. And we need to be able to pull in glass manufacturers, inverters, and others, and set some standards that can help reduce that market risk so that we can drive faster the R&D development more than just if we didn't have those standards.
Yeah, and one other, we have to talk to our suppliers with or without standards. What I've found is that they have their own idea of what PV is and what PV needs, and they try to help us, let's say, because PE you can use anything because it's just, you know, PV. And so in trying to help us, they really can dramatically hurt us in terms of the quality of the material. So that conversation has to happen. And maybe to some low level, at least, some standards would be useful.
Okay.
John, I feel compelled to just add one more thing here. I don't want anybody to leave here thinking there aren't standards. Since the early 1980s, there's been a consensus process throughout the industry that has been working on standards. There's a whole collection of standards that are accepted by the International Electrotechnical Commission and are followed by the manufacturers who are making modules and who are following the protocols for installing those. This is an electrical product going into power plants. So one set of standards that's in place relates to electricity and power plants. They're always evolving. They're always getting better. A lot of people have worked a very long time to create a collection of standards. You can go to the IEC TC82 is the working group. If you Google that, that's the first hit. It'll take you right to the page of dozens, if not hundreds, of standards related to what's used today to assure quality, the durability, the electrical integrity, the safety, and the related elements. And In addition to NREL and Sandia, Brookhaven National Lab has done a phenomenal job on environmental health and safety standards, has helped industry by doing audits, by coming and being an independent third-party validator of the safety. We can weave in the standards that have been created from other industries here to help speed up our ability to compete globally and to have that be a part of what we do. But I think we shortchanged the comments around standards. There are a lot of people who work as well closely with the team from NIST who worry with hundreds of pyranometers about how to calibrate the measurements that are made to assure the global integrity of what it is that is being offered and warranted for 25 years, that the power will be at least 80% of what it was on the first day after 25 years. So there's some very solid standards here. We're talking about complementing those, excuse me, with some additional details, how do machines interface to each other and communicate well in a fab? Those are standards that can be readily adapted from the IC industry and integrated into the fully automated fabs. There are collaborations with the glass industry, with the raw material suppliers, with every NATS little detail about what impurities to what level that sets the criteria, which is used by the purchasing departments in the manufacturing companies today that are related to standards. I had to get that off my chest. Thank you.
Okay. So we talked about collaboration, and I think there was a lot said about the differences between the PV, again, the PV industry and the semiconductor industry. Put simply, someone told me, I think it was probably Dick Swanson from SunPower, said, you know, the IC industry was one material set, infinite number of circuits. The PV industry is one circuit, infinite number of materials. So so that's always kind of framed up the problem in my mind. So obviously, where the IC industry was able to collaborate on materials, we clearly run into issues in PV. But going back to some of the other peripheral technical issues, and I throw out things like metrology, things like material handling, maybe deposition tooling at a very high level. Are there things like that that could be pre-competitive that offer an opportunity? And I also come back to, Doug, your chart, which showed very very plainly in terms of the cost breakdown for modules where they are now and probably will continue to be this way into the future, that the installation associated costs will continue to dominate the total system costs. So are there things in terms of collaboration that could be done industry-wide to address those or address other things? Realizing, again, that the analogy is not perfect, but looking at maybe a much more focused effort, are there some things that in your mind that offer some opportunity? Doug, if you want to start.
I do think that there's areas that fit that call. And there's some that are ongoing now. As far as inverters, there's a standard in place now for anti-islanding, interconnections, safety, but there is a very intense activity to take that to the next level, to be able to integrate to the smart grid and potentially push some of the control not only from utilities to the array, but even within the array to be able to match up PowerPoints. So both a lot of innovation and a lot of standards discussions. There are areas that the industry has poked at but hasn't closed on. The module energy rating is one that I'd love to see a good collaboration on. So consumers know that if they buy a particular module and put it in a particular climate, how much energy is it going to produce? And I think that there are a lot of areas where there's some natural collaboration that's possible, and we should find a way to encourage those, but allow those to develop organically while the top-down focuses on the big picture roadmap that we communicate up to the Congress and other constituents.
Okay. Charlie?
One of the things that struck me, John, when you were speaking earlier today, that I think is a core we could build on, centered around the role of national labs, and I want to kind of build on that thought for a moment here with the group. So NREL, teaming with Colorado School of Mines, Colorado State, University of Colorado Boulder, students like Doug Rose to my left here, went to, I think, School of Mines and did his R&D work at NREL. If I'm revising history, you can correct me. That there's a model that works really well that we could replicate here with the other national labs. And so it's exciting to me not only to see the breadth of the audience and the participation of the IC industry, but to see the other national labs recognize that we do have a mission that's the equivalent of the origin of the national labs with Sandia, Brookhaven, LBL, Argonne, Oak Ridge in particular. One of the guys in the Senate who blocked the renewable electricity standards from making a difference is a senator, you'll have to guess, one of two, from Tennessee. We can get Oak Ridge lined up here to be a part of things. It can make a difference. Pacific Northwest National Lab, I would add in, with the real-time grid simulator that exists at PNNL. It's incredibly important for our national competitiveness and for our ability to integrate renewables into the grid and to scale the adoption of renewables to be both a demand management tool as well as a peak shaving opportunity here. And time of day pricing can only help us get there quicker with what we can do with solar. And if we were to, you know, pick something, at least from the perspective that I have, and there's down in the weeds with certainly we need better metrology, but there's a higher order opportunity here. The U.S. lags China by a decade in this. We know we get real-time of day information 15 minutes late. That's the reason that we've had blackouts in the Northeast and the Northwest. The SCADA systems that are solar powered send the data, but they only gather and aggregate that every 15 minutes. In China, the grid has synchro phasers that are online so that you can see the waveform on the line, and you can begin to integrate real-time information into the grid as the grid gets expanded. The last time we added transmission in America, it took 19 years to get that permitted and done. So Dave showed us a chart this morning of, you know, 1 year here and a year and a half there. 19 years to do the transmission. So we have some big needs here that I think if we think big and we think about how to integrate renewables into the grid, move the power from the Southwest throughout the rest of the nation, just as the wind folks are thinking about bringing it from North Dakota to where it's needed. It's the same paradigm that the rest of the world is also planning on and is ahead of us in being able to integrate. So I'd vote for sort of pulling in the national labs more closely, building the relationships to the universities for the supply of brain power that we need for the jobs, and expanding the scope of how we think about this to the bigger scale of real-time use where we link solar in with the grid.
Okay. Kevin?
Yeah, John, I'm going to come at this question a little bit differently. So this whole discussion about pre-competitive, where can you collaborate without affecting competitiveness is an important topic for PV. But there's also another aspect to this, which is how much money do you need to truly achieve whatever the roadmap's going to be? And do these individual companies have enough money available to do that? From what I've seen, given the amount that they do have, you have the rate of improvement that you have today. And if that's adequate, for us in the United States to achieve our goals, whichever they may be, then we keep doing what we're doing. But if the competition outside the United States is moving at a faster pace, we have to do something differently. And we may have to bump into this issue of what's pre-competitive and what's not. This is a very different industry than the semiconductor industry, as people have mentioned. But at the same time, if you attempt to avoid this competitive barrier, this pre-competitive barrier, I'm afraid you may not succeed. And so I think it's worthwhile to figure out, on the one hand, what's pre-competitive, what's not, and then on the other hand, how much money do individual companies need to succeed from a U.S. perspective? And if that's not enough, then collaboration has to take place. A pooling of resources would be required. This is what happened in the semiconductor industry for different reasons.
If you can hold that question 1 second, I'm going to get to the rest of the panel.
I think one of the biggest challenges today, taking it slightly different, commenting on Charlie's, is that the industry, the solar industry today, the biggest area that I see is we're unable to commercialize technologies quick enough, whereas the Chinese have done that very effectively. And that's not due to throwing money at it. It's due to there's a lack of skilled knowledge people who commercialize technologies. Many of the industries, we are in advanced technologies, but the transfer from lab to full-scale production is a lot more difficult than we estimate and takes a lot longer. And the real challenge we have is to be able to commercialize that, not from throwing money at, but the knowledge talent that's moving from the semiconductor industry into the solar industry needs to occur. I'll give two prime examples. The most successful companies in the U.S. today are First Solar and SunPower from a perspective of that. Dick Swanson credits T.J. Rogers, forcing him to go down to Austin for 6 months to prove that you could run this process day in, day out, consistently. And the challenge we have is to do that is a very large effort to baseline processes, to do DOEs, to do CPKs, and to have that rigidity around process development that's not in the industry today. And we need the talent pool in here from a knowledge and experience basis that can help us drive these technologies to market a lot faster than we currently do.
Picking up on that a little bit from a different perspective, we also need the talent pool from new hires, let's put it that way. We need to build on that. And one way to do that is to work within some of these consortia like SISOC, I'll put in a plug for George, where the industry members can determine what's pre-competitive and what's not pre-competitive and develop their own working relationships that way, at the same time stimulating and helping students come through that pipeline with then experience in PV so that we have people that we can hire, knowledgeable people that don't just come in completely green.
Okay. I'd like to go back to John, since you on this panel, I think, represent sort of the unique role in terms of being a very early stage startup. Can you talk about some of the, and elaborate on what you just said about some of the particular challenges early stage startups have today, right now, as opposed to maybe 12 months ago when the financing environment was much more favorable? And along the lines that we've just been talking about in terms of collaboration, road mapping, workforce development, can you give us a little bit more view in terms of from a startup standpoint?
Sure. I can tell you there's almost no investment environment out there today. Unfortunately, VCs consider solar as a commodity, which is a death knell for any time you're trying to raise money. If you haven't started raising it and you're in a commodity business, whether it's high tech or solar or anything, they don't get into it. And so it is very hard to convince VCs, even though you might have innovative technologies that can shift the game, to invest in you. And that's a key part. The other part that's very interesting is that the VCs, and this is really driving where our industry goes because they are major funding of it, is that they really want CapEx efficiency, not because necessarily that, the major reason is their model is to invest $20 to $30 million in a company between three of them and have it go IPO. when you need $250 million, that fits a PE model, not a VC model at the end of the day. So the challenges we faced were, one is, number one, showing that there was not a whole new sets of equipment that were necessary to be used for us to get to our process. They don't want that. The technology risk has to be, as one guy out of Brad Mattson, who founded a number of companies and is at Vantage Point now, says, every startup he looks at has one piece of equipment that has a high risk of not working overall, and therefore they're unwilling to invest in that because that piece is not there, or it's not available today, or they don't know if it can be inserted into a process that the rest of the process works, because some processes are highly integrated. So the challenge there is, one is very high CapEx efficiencies they want to see. Two is that your time to market is 1 to 2 years overall. And three is basically that you really need to run it on a very lean model overall. And you only achieve that as a startup by having the ability to use like an SVTC or some other type of prototyping facility that allows you to take your one area of technology, prove it, and then be able to sell it with the entire supply chain still intact. And that's what's going to drive, at least from a startup perspective, innovation, is that I go back to standardization of, say, equipment interfaces and the ability to say, I'll innovate this one piece that will drive 0.5%, but then I can sell to many manufacturers, is going to be pretty fundamental to us. Because startups are under a lot of pressure right now from that perspective. So the ability to quickly raise funds and get to commercialization is a fundamental today with a very low CapEx requirement.
All right. I just want to talk a little bit about universities. It's been mentioned a little bit. What do you see as some of the obstacles to working more closely with universities? And maybe relate what you're doing right now, what you'd like to be doing, and what are the obstacles maybe to making that happen? Jim, I don't know if you want to take first.
At the moment at SolarWorld, we have, let's say, two significant relationships with universities. Within Oregon, there is a consortium of universities. Some are really good in characterization, some are really good in engineering. And so we're working with those. Typical of one is that we have interns at the undergraduate level. Will come in and work for, let's say, 9 months or whatever in the factory. They use that information, write papers, and helps get their bachelor's degrees. We're working with another university that actually will have master's degree students working within the factory, writing their thesis, et cetera, based upon the work they do. The plan, at least at the moment, is that while they are at the factory, they will actually be employees. So they gain a little bit in that regard. As a company, we get the opportunity to evaluate them, and clearly they're on probation, if you want to look at it that way. But clearly, if they do the job and they are good, then we hire them. It's really that simple. So it's really a win-win situation, and the big win, frankly, is that if we have these people on site, then we get half price on any analytical tests we want to run at the university. So it pays off.
Okay. John or Kevin?
Yeah. John. As IBM has been looking at how to participate in the technology development side of PV and creating some collaboration models, we've been talking to universities. And we believe that we will be able to use the SRC model that you heard discussed earlier today. The attributes of that model, how they handle intellectual property, how it's funded, so on and so forth, will work fine. So in that regard, we'll look to the SRC model as our primary model for working with universities.
Okay. Charlie, Doug, anything to add?
Applied Materials, we work today with about a dozen different universities. both on very specialized projects, typically electronic or optical modeling tasks. We also are part of the SRC program I heard about earlier to, again, build out on the modeling. We're part of the consortium related to the silicon work that George and North Carolina State, Georgia Tech, and others are involved in. Participate in working with universities either directly or through these kinds of consortia as what we see as a critical part of building up the talent pool. And it's, I think the one message I'd like to convey here is the continuity. Jim Seitz referred to it a bit in his presentation. You think about folks that we hire today, some of them have come to us from places like Caltech, where Nate Lewis, who is a student of Dick Bube's at Stanford working on solar, launched the competency throughout the industry that we're now able to draw on. And even though the PhD work was on excitons, the knowledge necessary just to measure a multi-junction device is something that was, you know, right away that student came in and went to work. And similarly, students who've been with Ajit Rohatgi at Georgia Tech, Steve Hegedus at Institute of Energy Conversion, University of Delaware, folks out of Martin Green's University of New South Wales, all of them are folks who have come to work for us in our operations. And so that continuity over a long period of time, those labs and those students are the way that we've been able to go from 5 employees 3.5 years ago to 1,500 today. 5, 10 years ago, that would have been impossible to do. So we need those students to be in that pipeline.
Okay. Just real quick.
And I think the universities and the student programs at the national labs are crucial to the progress the industry has made and will make. And I'd love to see the recommendations that Jim Seitz presented today be implemented.
Okay. All right. So we'll go ahead and open it up for a few questions. And George, if you want to go ahead and lead us off.
I'm George Rizgagni from North Carolina State University. And earlier, Kevin mentioned about the money available and the rate of progress and so on. But at the time, I'm looking up there, it says partnering for manufacturing. We have the industry here. We just had a brief, somewhat token discussion about universities. But what we haven't had, and I bring that up, is the government partnering between agencies. And a woman earlier got up and said that she wanted some action items. She was asked to go home from this meeting with a list of things to present to her legislator bosses and tell them what to do. So what I would like to have as part of this wonderful gathering of people and meeting is a list of action items. I mean, I have my personal action items that follow up on the university. Mm-hmm. And one of the recent in May, Obama, $120 million was put into an energy program, and $21 million was put into installation training for installers to put panels on roofs. $21 million. And they were going to set up a center for another $6 million. Now, if I look at my colleagues in the States that need graduate students, I would say we need a program. Put this on your list. We need a program that will have a competitive submission for applications for graduate school, and this is what we will give you for 3 years of graduate school and make it attractive enough so that people will apply. We'll get a pool of applicants. If there are 100 of them and you can only give 10 or so of these awards, you've got those 90 other applicants. It's limited to U.S. citizens. You're going to get more graduate students that are U.S. citizens. So That's one item. Another item has to do with equipment, the lab equipment. We need a thing focused PV enhancements to their interaction with industry. We do the diagnostic equipment at NC State. They do the processing. They had a DOE center at Georgia Tech. They do simulations at Texas Tech. They have got their computers and so on. We need to have focused action item for enhancing these PV-oriented university programs. And in the context of the Silicon Solar Consortia, we got members on your board that are participating. I think somehow the government and the NSF program should be recognized for what it is, industry-university cooperative research, and in some way coordinated with the DOE and DOD and NIST and the national labs. So I think there is a need right now to make a list of action items for other subgroups of our attendees today.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing as how I made that request, just to follow up on that, first I'd like to say that I definitely would like to see any suggestions you all have, please send them my way. I can never get enough suggestions about types of initiatives that we might be interested in taking up, and you know, we'll let you know if you're bugging us too much. Up to this point, I definitely would say bug us more, please. But in addition to your individual requests, I think part of the point of what I was trying to say is that we'd like to see more coordinated efforts. We'd like to see not just your individual requests, but what you all feel that you need collectively. And we need you know, I would like to see you all working together more, and not just in what you're asking us to do, but in just coming together and understanding what you all need to do as well. So that's a major part of my request.
Thank you. Sure. Go ahead.
The point of student funding for PV, I think, is a good example of the bigger picture that Dr. Razgani was referring to. When I started my PhD fellowship, was through the photonics program. You know, the professor really wanted to do PV, and he said, "Well, close enough. Here's your fellowship. Do PV." But it's only one example. The big picture is, in order for the U.S. to be competitive, there's a lot more we need to do. When I was at NREL and when I was at First Solar, I used to worry that if we don't make progress in reducing costs, PV may never fulfill its potential. That it just will always be the technology of the future, and it won't get there, and other things we'll have to get by with other alternatives. The good news is that's no longer the case. PV in the rest of the world is going to be very successful, and a few of the U.S. companies will also be part of that. The challenge before us is, what can we do in the U.S. to have it a large manufacturing and base of use here? And it will take things that are on a big scale, because the other countries are doing that. And when you look at how much we spend on crushing old clunkers of cars or some of these various things, and compare that to what we're spending on PV and the importance of it, I think it really stands out, and particularly when we compare it to what these other countries are spending. So if we come out of this with the need to create those to do things, there would be coordination of the labs, pulling in more of those labs that are working on other things, working on this, funding those downstream, building that downstream channels through the aiding demand with, for instance, the Green Bank. When we put that full list together, I think then we'll have the action plan that will make the U.S. the leader in clean tech, instead of wondering why those other countries were so successful.
Okay. I want to keep getting to questions here. Rich, do you have
a
question?
Yes, John. I wanted to really have a closing comment that's positive for this session, so everybody can enjoy their beer and wine tonight. And I got a venture capital Google alert today, And it is, photovoltaic company announces new venture capital funding. Suniva, a Georgia-based manufacturer of photovoltaic panels, has announced $75 million in new venture funding. And Warburg Pincus was the lead with a consortium of other venture capital firms. It's going to be, they manufacture panels with an efficiency rate of 18%. It's going to be used to install its second 64-megawatt production line in Norcross. And the closing paragraph is, the news may also be a positive sign for the solar industry as at large, because venture capital funding had been tougher for many companies to come across at the height of the recession. Still, funding for renewable power and energy efficiency companies has remained relatively strong, even in the light of difficult financial conditions. So this is just one company, it's one funding, but it's PV, it's positive, and I think it's a good thing to celebrate and have a beer and wine over.
My email earlier today. Today, we don't have a Suniva person here because it was their board of directors needed. And I got an email today saying Suniva will be joining the CISOP consortium. So there are many other repercussions.
Are there any questions? But not that we don't mind that, but are there any questions for the panel that we can go ahead and wrap up on in the interest of time? I want to get to all the audience participation. Did you have a question?
I had a question and a comment.
Okay.
David King. In my former life, I've worked for NIST. I've worked for a number of federal agencies. I've worked with a range of entrepreneurs and companies. And I'd like to make a couple of comments that I think have been missed about the value of roadmaps, and in particular the Semitech kind of a roadmap. That's a very powerful instrument for federal agencies to judge the merit in peer-reviewed grant and funding applications. So it is used for disbursement of federal funds for what is viewed as being germane, commercial, and technology at the right point in time. It's also a very powerful tool for companies inventing technology and developing technology, not only materials but manufacturing equipment. And this goes largely to companies outside of your very small, narrow sphere of influence. There are people who are developing technologies or have technology portfolios that will feed into your needs in reducing the costs over the next 10 or 20 years, but they need to know two things. When is that technology going to be germane, and what market are you offering for that technology? It does me no good to have a technology that is too early for your market. If you don't have the demand, if you don't have the capacity, if you don't have the volume to meet my development and growth needs, you're not a viable customer for me. If you are, then it's technology that I have that is suitable for pursuing for you as well as possibly other types of applications. And the third thing is it's a powerful tool for people to learn if they're in graduate school or high school or elementary school, when are these new technologies going to come on board? When are the jobs going to come on board? For an older person, it might be, is this a field where I want to retrain myself? I mean, clearly, if it's going to be 15 years before you're creating new jobs, that's not a place for me to be. If you're going to be creating new jobs in the next 3 to 5 years, the roadmap will tell me this. So that was the comment I wanted to make. The question is, what happens when you reach grid parity? There's been some talk about Moore's Law and the pacing of Moore's Law.
I think that's a great question for a follow-on workshop on grid integration, which the DOE would be very happy to sponsor. In all seriousness, that's a great topic that we would actually love to engage the industry on.
Yeah, I think Bettina showed us that there is a pacing factor. That's about a factor of two drop projected cost.
So I think that's a whole very rich and very interesting and useful discussion to have. I'm actually going to cut this off here because I know that we're standing in between you and refreshments. I'd like to thank our panel for participating. I'd like to thank all of you for showing up and staying. I would like to thank the Academy for sponsoring this, and also for, I want to note, practicing very good energy efficiency with the air conditioning. Coming from the department, we certainly recognize that. So thank you all very much.